All right, we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Devery Anderson. I'm moderating this session. And the session title is Two Diaries, Two Eras, Telling the Story of Mormonism, 1951 to 1997. I know the program says 1999. A little confusion. Leonard Arrington died in 1999, but his diaries go up to 1997. And so these two diaries combined cover those years of 51 to 97. We were to have three of people on this in the session today speaking. Christina Rossetti is not able to be here because there was a death that happened this last week that someone she was close to, and she's at that funeral today. So we'll have an. Okay. I'm just deciding who's going first here, and I'll read their bios in that order. But a little bit about the session, since we have a little bit more time, I'll just go ahead and read this abstract. The recent publication of two diaries shed important light on LDS history during the second half of the 20th century. David O. McKay's presidential diaries were kept faithfully by McKay and his longtime secretary, Claire Middlemiss, during McKay's tenure as church president from 1951 to 1970. The diaries reveal important information about McKay's day-to-day administrative duties as well as his deep faith. They also reveal some of his lesser known weaknesses, his interaction with others within the hierarchy, and his own disdain for conflict all emerge, telling the story of faith and humanity, commitment and struggle, all part of his role in guiding the church as he saw fit. Leonard Arrington, on the other hand, wrote from the perspective of a trained academic. His call as church historian in 1972 ushered in a new era of professionalization at the LDS Church Historical Department. Despite his call by the First Presidency to oversee that new era and a sustaining vote in General Conference, he soon found himself battling more conservative members of the hierarchy while being supported by others. Like McKay, Arrington remained faithful and committed to his church. Arrington documented his experience knowing that his record would one day be scrutinized by historians. Together, these diaries span almost the entirety of the Latter-day Saint experience during the second half of the 20th century and provide fresh glimpses into the inner workings of the Mormon hierarchy. McKay's and Middlemiss's perspective is that of the office of the president. Arrington worked across the courtyard and often with many of McKay's contemporaries, including his successors as president. The two perspectives from the different vantage points are crucial to understanding Mormonism from its post-war period through the Cold War. And so our speakers today are the editors of these two volumes, which I brought them here. The McKay Diaries, since Gary's speaking first, this three-volume set here is the Arrington Diaries. Gary James Bergera is managing editor of the Smith Pettit Foundation in Salt Lake City and currently managing director of Signature Books. And he's the editor of other compilations of personal writings by historical figures as well. The autobiography of B.H. Roberts and On Desert Trails with Everett, is it Roos? I always see it. Roos, okay. It's one of these things I always read but never pronounce. So, he was the general editor of Signature's Significant Mormon Diary series and author of Conflict in the Quorum, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young, Joseph Smith. He's received awards from the Dialogue Foundation, Journal of Mormon History, and Utah Historical Society, and won the Leonard Arrington Lifetime Achievement Award as well a couple years ago here at MHA, or was it last year? Last year, sorry. He's on the editorial boards of the Journal of Mormon History and John Wimmer Historical Association as well. Harvard S. Heath is former curator of the Utah and American West Archives at the Harold B. Lee Library, Brigham Young University, where he earned his PhD. He's the editor of In the World, the Diaries of Reed Smoot, and a contributor to the modern edition of James E. Talmage's 1911 House of the Lord, a study of holy sanctuaries, ancient and modern. He's also the lead researcher for BYU President Ernest L. Wilkinson's four-volume history, Brigham Young University, the First 100 Years. So we will hear from both of for Gary and Harvard, and then we'll have time for questions afterwards.
It's tempting to want to, given the size, it's tempting to want to just stand in front of the podium. But I'm not sure if it's being recorded or not, so I'm just going to stay back here. My comments are written out. I have a very hard time just speaking extemporaneously, so I hope that you'll bear with me as I read these. In thinking about what might be of most interest to the majority of you today regarding the publication of the diaries of Leonard Arrington, I've decided that rather than attempt to summarize the contents of the diaries, I would provide some background onto the origins of the project. And then if there are specific issues that you're interested in during the question and answer, I'd be happy to try to remember what the Arrington Diaries said about those. Discussions with the Arrington family, as represented by Susan Arrington Madsen, the youngest child and only daughter of Leonard and Grace Arrington, regarding the publication of the diaries, began in late 2011. I think that the principal goal of these discussions was to gain a better understanding of each party's hopes and expectations. A formal contract between the Smith Pettit Foundation and the Arrington Family Trust was signed on January 10, 2012. At that point, work on preparing the diaries in earnest began. While Arrington maintained diaries prior to 1971, I decided to focus on those years that I believed would be of greatest interest to the majority of readers. Thus, the published version begins shortly before Leonard Arrington's appointment as LDS Church historian, which occurred in early 1972, continues through his directorship of the LDS Church History Division and of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History, and concludes with the years of his retirement. Though he kept diaries before his appointment as church historian, not until that time did Arrington approach the task of documenting his life with the focus and self-awareness that characterized the undertaking thereafter. Sometime between 1972 and February 1974, Arrington began to assemble in letter-sized loose-leaf binders a series of scrapbooks he labeled diary. These scrapbooks included, among other items, copies of diary entries he had recorded previously. After 1981, Arrington abandoned the scrapbooks, but continued to keep a diary as loose letter-sized sheets. Arrington's papers were acquired by the library at Utah State University in stages, beginning in 1982, and continuing until after Arrington's death in early 1999. As is common practice, the library's special collections staff disassembled the 24 scrapbooks covering the period from birth through 1981 and placed the pages in archival folders and boxes. These diaries today comprise boxes 21 to 35 of Arrington's papers. Boxes 36 to 52 contain the remainder of Arrington's diary from 1982 on. On January 7, 1959, Arrington began to maintain with greater regularity a diary, usually typed. From 1959 to November 1971, Arrington's diary reads mostly like an appointment calendar, with the occasional brief annotation or note to self. However, when it became clear in late 1971 that Arrington's career might take a significant turn, he decided, prompted by his son Carl, to document more fully major events in his life. Thereafter, through December 1981, Arrington's diary contains, in addition to Arrington's typed diary entries, an even greater variety of autobiographical material, including, but not limited to, copies of letters to and from Arrington, minutes of meetings of LDS Church Historical Department executives and managers, internal reports, usually generated by the Historical Department, brief excerpts from the diaries of some colleagues, copies of speeches, clippings from newspaper and magazine articles, obituaries, the printed programs of history conferences and similar meetings, local and regional LDS Church bulletins and announcements, public statements and press releases, theater, plays, musicals, operas, ballets, etc. programs, trips and vacation itineraries, airplane tickets, hotel and restaurant bills, restaurant menus, greeting cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards, miscellaneous memoranda, and scraps of printed and other material Arrington believed to be important. Arrington's shift in how he maintained his diary, beginning in late 1981, early 1982, seems to have been prompted by the gradual redefinition beginning in 1977-78 of his job from church historian to director of the Church History Division and of his division's subsequent relocation, which was finalized in August 1982, from the Church Historical Department in Salt Lake City to the newly created Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History at BYU in Provo. Evidently, Arrington came to view his formal diary entries as of decreasing importance given his move away from church headquarters, his diminishing involvement in the daily grind of history, professional history making, and the approach of his retirement in 1987. As he grew older, and especially in retirement, Arrington recorded fewer and shorter diary entries. He continued to insert other material in his diary, but it appears that health, energy, and interest lagged. Also, since he no longer enjoyed secretarial support, what diary entries he did compose, he usually typed himself rather than dictated. What seems to be the last formal diary type entry is dated January 10, 1997, a little more than 2 years before Arrington's death. To an extent before 1997, but especially after, Arrington's regular letters to his three children function increasingly as the primary chronological narrative of his life, though the focus of the letters is more personal than professional. Arrington's diary, as with all autobiographical texts, is a construction of self. In Arrington's case, the author's self-awareness may be more intentional than in most others. Arrington appreciated the historical and political value of maintaining a diary and addressed readers accordingly. That said, Arrington, as a diarist, typically writes more as a historian seeking balance and understanding than as, say, an attorney arguing a client's case, regardless of the merits of the opponent's allegations. While Arrington is certain to record his version of events, he does not shy away from offering judgments of others as well as of himself. In fact, Arrington's occasional self-criticism serves as a tonic to help render more nuanced the reader's own judgments of Arrington especially. Arrington may be his own most articulate defender, but he is also his own most knowledgeable critic. His sometimes clinical self-awareness endows his diary with a heightened degree of honesty. It may be tempting to view Arrington as something of a jovial good old boy, an Idaho-born chicken rancher, whose interests did not extend much beyond the soil and livestock of the American West. It was a persona Arrington himself cultivated. Yet in many ways, nothing could be farther from the truth. Arrington was, in every sense of the term, an intellectual engagé, more so than he often let on. He was a voracious Catholic reader whose interests ran the gamut. He enjoyed art and the theater in almost all forms, appreciated music, especially Italian opera, kept abreast of current national and world affairs, was intensely curious and broad-minded. His religious, political, and social beliefs veered usually, but not always, toward the mainstream and occasionally liberal. His belief in the fundamental truth claims of his church, as he understood and interpreted them, was unwavering. He was suspicious of dogmatism and authoritarianism. He avoided making judgments, but he also held some strong opinions. He both celebrated and was leery of modernity. He was an incurable workaholic, could be optimistic to a fault and non-confrontational to his own detriment. His diaries reveal a man committed to, victimized by, yet in important ways transcendent of his time and culture. As soon as the decision to publish the diaries was reached and an electronic scan of the originals was made in early 2012, independent historian Artis Parshall prepared a preliminary transcription, and as an aside, Artis is here today, so I hope she doesn't mind the shout out. Following Parshall's work, I proofed and reproofed the transcription against the scans of the originals. Missing entries, when they were discovered, were supplied by either Susan Arrington Madsen or by the USU Library's Special Collections Department, which I then transcribed, proofed a second time, and inserted where they belonged. In formatting the diaries for publication, I adopted a handful of editorial conventions that departed from the original text. I arranged the entries into chapters, titled the chapters, and provided chapter epigraphs. I standardized the dates placed at the beginning of each dated diary entry. I sometimes inserted bracketed text in an entry to facilitate comprehension. Otherwise, I placed all editorial intrusions in footnotes. I hope that the editorial apparatus will benefit the reader without detracting from Arrington's original creation. Regarding the identification of people in the diaries, I tried to annotate using publicly available information the men and women who appeared to be significant in Arrington's life. I did not attempt to identify people whom Arrington mentioned only in passing, nor did I try to identify all the major events in a person's life, only those that seemed most relevant and most useful in helping to place the person in the context of the diaries. The majority of errors and possibly inadequacies that exist in the annotations will probably be found in the identifications of people. Do any who may find the facts of his or her life or the lives of his or her family members misstated or less than fully stated, I apologize in advance. In principle, I am opposed to the redaction or censorship of historical documents. However, while editing the Arrington Diaries for publication, I confronted a handful of entries that caused me to confront my opposition. I believe that redaction risks incomplete history, that it compromises both the historical enterprise and the search for historical truth. It not only deprives writers and readers of benefiting from as full a treatment of the topic under discussion as possible, it actually contributes to a distorted account of the past. In addition, redaction infantilizes readers. Those making redactions tell readers, in effect, that they are not to be trusted in using the materials being redacted, in interpreting the materials being redacted, and in arriving at their own conclusions regarding the redacted materials. Decisions about what we see, whatever the reason, treats readers as being unable to be trusted with the truth. While I remain committed in principle to the above objections to redaction, I arrived at a handful of instances in the Arrington Diaries where I decided to redact the historical documents. The published edition of the diaries comprises 3 volumes, each totaling about 800 to 900 pages. All told, I redacted the names of people in a total of 12 dated diary entries, 2 in Volume 1, 3 in Volume 2, and 7 in Volume 3. When I began work on the diaries in 2012, I did not expect to redact any material. Thus, I did not formulate any policies beforehand regarding redaction. However, as I began to work my way through the diary, and especially as I started to annotate the text, I encountered some entries containing material regarding persons who I discovered were living that I decided could be read as possibly problematic to those living individuals. Rather than attempt to create a broad one-category-fits-all redaction, which seemed to me to be unworkable, I decided to consider each potential redaction on its own. Throughout the project, redaction remained a subjective undertaking. But as I made my way through the task of annotation, I became increasingly less uncomfortable with my admittedly subjective decisions. That said, I suspect that some readers will agree with my decisions and that other readers won't. The majority of the redactions seems to fall within the category we today might term privacy concerns. They relate to matters involving divorce, excommunication, mental illness, sexual activity, etc. Perhaps the redaction-related question I most struggled with was that connected with the entry dated March 15, 1985. This redaction involved the identification of a living married couple who had received their temple-related second anointings and who, in the case of the wife, had written a poem about the experience that was published in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Throughout the editing process and into typesetting, the couple, to the best of my knowledge, had never publicly acknowledged receiving the second anointing, and the wife's poem was vague enough that I believe the majority of readers would never guess that her poem deals with the ordinance. So I had decided to redact the couple's names in the published version of the diaries. However, after typesetting, one of the proofers pointed out that the poem had been printed under the author's real name 3 years later in the Sisters in Spirit anthology. Consequently, based on the author's own outing of herself as the author of the poem, I ultimately decided not to redact her and her husband's names. In titling the publication of the diaries, Confessions of a Mormon Historian, I drew some inspiration from Arrington himself. One of the possible titles he toyed with for his autobiography, published in 1998 as Adventures of a Church Historian, was Confessions. I also like and find it appropriate that the verb confess traces back to the Latin confessio, meaning to acknowledge, and may refer specifically to acknowledging one's faith or matters of one's faith. As Gary Wills points out in his brief biography of St. Augustine and his Confessions, quote, "The term that best covers this range of meanings for confessio is testimony," end quote. Thus, and despite confession's corollary as admitting to transgression, etc., I think confessions as testimony, accurately represents the contents of the diaries. The published version of the Arrington Diaries represents the combined efforts of many people, in addition to me. These include, but are not limited to, Artis Parshall, Susan Arrington Madsen, who proofed the entire annotated transcript several times, Becky Bartholomew, who adapted her several studies of Arrington into a standalone biographical introduction, Christine Rigby Arrington, Richard Jensen, and Brian Buchanan, who each separately proofed the entire manuscript and caught more than a few errors, Levina Fielding Anderson and Joseph Geisner, Thomas Alexander, Jeff Johnson, Bradford Cole, and the members of the staff at Special Collections, Utah State University, Janie Fleet and members of the staff at Signature Books, including Ron Prittis, John Hatch, Devery Anderson, Keiko Jones, and designer Jason Francis. If you like the look of the diaries, that's all Jason. And George D. Smith and the Smith Pettit Foundation, who gave me time, the time to work on the diaries. I would like to conclude with a few hopefully non-spoilerish readings from Arrington's writings. The first is from his diary, entry dated December 12, 1976, and I think encapsulates the difficulties he found himself facing at LDS headquarters, his frustrations with his own inability as how best to respond, and his temperament in such situations. Quote, "My experience in working for the church for now almost 5 years suggests several comments. First, I find the church in most instances to be a beneficent employer. That is, the church will be compassionate with an employee in a manner that a private employer would not. It will try to salvage a life, a situation, a deteriorating health or social or family relationship. Second, the church, being led primarily by older people, will attempt to get by as cheaply as possible. We'll pay less than competitive businesses pay, we'll grant smaller increases than competitive businesses will grant, we'll resist upgrading salary scales, we'll feel that the church should pay less than comparative salaries. The church will lag behind other businesses and institutions in introducing improvements in its salary scales, we'll make changes reluctantly and grudgingly. Third, in positions like mine, which are sensitive, the security is less than in a university, in the federal government and private business. One feels more insecure because he is subject to arbitrary action by any member of the ecclesiastical bureaucracy, and he sees every week examples of such arbitrary action. Fourth, there are administrative problems in dealing with the hierarchy. Some of these are the product of the particular personalities. Our own approach is somewhat as follows. We want to determine a matter of policy. We take it to Elder Joseph Anderson, the managing director of the church historical department. Elder Anderson does not make a decision. Almost never does he make a decision. He recommends that we take that question to the advisors to the 12. The advisors almost never make a decision. They recommend we take it to the first presidency. We do not receive answers on many of the questions we take to the first presidency. The first presidency wants to discuss it with the 12. It never gets on the agenda of the 12, or if it does make the agenda, they do not get to it. Or if they get to it, someone asks a question about it, which our advisors can't answer, so it is referred to them to get an answer. They subsequently ask us the question, we provide an answer, they get back to the 12. By that time, the 12 have another question. We have had several of our proposals follow precisely this route, with no decision in a year or even two. This has happened on our proposal for a 6-volume biography of Brigham Young, on our proposal to do a study of the operations of plural marriage, and on other matters of this type. This could be solved very easily if the 12 would have one of us outside their council room during the discussion, prepared to give an answer to any question that might be asked. Fifth, we have observed instances in which a member of the 12 sounded off about our work without really knowing what we were trying to do or why, and without consulting us, our advisors, or our managing director, and without giving them or us a chance to answer the charges. We have also experienced only one instance in which we have been praised or appreciation expressed for any of our books, articles, or any other accomplishment. It is normal for an employer to expect occasional expressions of appreciation for his work, and we try to do this for our own employees. But with all the books we have published and articles, we have never had written or oral communications from Elder Anderson, our advisors, members of the Quorum of the 12, or the First Presidency about them." End quote. The next and last are two from Arrington's letters to his children. and were written on dates after the period of time covered in the published diaries, and so do not appear in the publication. The first is the last letter Arrington ever wrote, and is dated January 29, 1999. At the time, Arrington was in the hospital and dictated the following to his daughter, Susan. I think it summarizes well Arrington's orientation to life and interest in chronicling an accurate history. It reads, quote, "Dear children, I got to thinking the other day something that sounds strange is that when I was looking after chickens on the Twin Falls, Idaho farm, the chickens used to get lice, and I used to put on the roosts a liquid that seeps up from the roosts and kills all the lice. Apparently, in going through all this, I myself picked up lice. And I can remember lice in my hair, and buying a little narrow comb, I could pick up any lice that was there. It helped me realize what a pretty bad health status we were in. We picked up tainted typhoid fever. In fact, I had it at least twice, both times from tainted ditch water, which we drank all year. It had come from where the cows had sloshed, human beings had defecated, and birds had left their droppings. Susie wants to know why I didn't get cholera, but none of us did. And we were lucky not to get tuberculosis like Brigham Young's mother and first wife, but of course we did get, in succession, mumps, whooping cough, scarlet fever, diphtheria, measles, both red and German, and the flu. I'm grateful to Susie for this dictation. One of these days I hope to type my own. Love, Dad." End quote. The last is dated a year earlier, February 11, 1998. I believe it best encapsulates Arrington's tendency to nostalgia, as well as his hopeful view of the larger world. It reads, quote, "Sometimes my work is such that I take my walk at night, up and down 22nd East Street, and sometimes up and down 22nd East Street, and sometimes up 22nd and down to Oneida Street and up to 21st South, and then back home to on 22nd East. The windows in the houses glow, as do the streetlights, and the rows of lights we erected a couple of years ago on every other house next to the street. I see the windows shivering with gold and amber, and our yard lights, strong and beautiful assertions of the light. As I crush the thick caked snow under my shoes, I do not wear boots. I think of my children and grandchildren. Good thoughts, beautiful, satisfying thoughts. You are all like lights. Lights to my mind, to my soul, to my life." An article in a magazine reminds us of Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent, the end of which is a scene in which the radio station goes out during the Blitz, and Joel McRae calls into the mic, "Hello, America, hang on to your lights, they're the only lights left in the world." John Milton died blind, out of the light. A last writing was, "When I consider how my light is spent," maybe he meant life. Goethe's reported last words were, "More light." Do you remember the song we used to sing as children, "This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine"? You did. Have you ridden in an airplane at night and noticed how much dark space there is between the necklaces of light? Sometimes I hate to end my walk when I'm traveling late at night. Many lights went out, but there was always in my mind the lights that came from you. End quote. As I contemplate the diaries, I have come to believe that the careful reading of them will bring the reader as close to knowing another person as is possible. I have also come to believe that every reader's experience with Arrington in his diaries will be different. Thank you for the opportunity of being able to share with you some of my thoughts on editing the diaries of Leonard Arrington.
Took my watch off, but there's no point in that, is there? We got plenty of time, so I won't pay attention to that. My approach would be a little different than Gary's. I'm going to talk about diaries in general and refer to some of the things that Leonard did, but mostly on President McKay. I want to begin by reading two poems, which I think relate to our situation today. The first one is one you've heard many times by Omar Khayyam, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all the piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor shall all thy tears wash out a word of it. Diaries are pretty rigid and pretty everlasting. The second poem comes from a Mormon poet and author, Carolyn Pearson, was written some 3 decades ago, but I think it bears on diaries. Her poem was entitled Journal. Put the thought in words and the words in ink, in a page, in a book, in a very private place, like under a mattress, a sacred process, wonderful as alchemy, is at work even in the dark, while you sleep, making something better than history, understanding. And that's what diaries do, I believe, in these two cases here. Not only history, but more importantly, understanding. I'm going to give you a little personal odyssey of my relationship with President McKay and history and some of the things that we can be aided by in the reading of these diaries. And by the way, this is almost 3,500 pages, but they're all page-turners. I mean, it gives you a view, as Gary has mentioned, into the life of not only these men, but our lives as we live through these experiences. I will start out by stating that early in my academic career, I was enthralled with my first class in colonial history and came aware of the Puritans and their lives, their views, especially their penchant for diary keeping. And then I began to think, you know, there's a lot about Mormons and Puritans that is very similar. And then I read Davis Bitten's attempt to compile a list of all the Mormon diaries out there. I believe there was some like close to 3,000 he had gone through. And in common, they tried to justify their lives before God and to try and discuss in their own way how one should live, what one sees in their lives, signs of the times, their culture, and was very introspective and revealing, and I think beneficial. And we all know the 19th century experience in Mormonism was inundated with thousands of diaries. And I've read a lot of these and a lot of other diaries, and they are the most wonderful way to do good primary research. Most of them are not very interesting, but the ones that are really good. I also am somewhat disappointed in myself. As an historian and an archivist, I don't have a diary. I won't ask for a raise of hands how many of you are in my situation. I know they're important. I've tried a number of occasions to keep a diary. But I always excuse myself. Married, school, 2 jobs, graduate degree, 9 kids. You know, just never time to sit out at night and do a diary. And I regret that. I have friends who have kept diaries, and I wish I was one of them, because it does give what the poem indicated, understanding. Before I get into some personal accounts of my interaction with President McKay's diary, we should think about who these two men are and the context in which they lived. Think about it. We have a diary here from 1951 to 1997, almost a half a century in the late 20th century. And yet, who are these men? President McKay was born in 1873. I mean, think about that, 1873. That's before Custer's Last Stand. Brigham Young is still alive. And he is a mature man at the turn of the century. And in the 20s, he's a more than middle-aged. He experiences the 20s, the Depression, the war, then becomes president of the church at age 77. Leonard Arrington, born in the 19-teens, saw problems with recession, farming in Idaho, the depression, went to war, came back and got his degree. He was much later than President McKay, but they both have a certain pioneer commonality. And they both have a commonality, and they were both raised on farms. And there's something about being raised on a farm that you never forget. And I, when you read Leonard's diaries and President McKay's diaries, you find this sense of land, this sense of community, this sense of belonging. And that had an impact on both their lives. And you'll read in the Arrington diaries, especially in Volume 3, where he'll spend many of the pages recollecting his youth in Twin Falls, Idaho, growing up on a farm. And President McKay would, as often as he could, leave Salt Lake and drive back to Huntsville for the weekend or longer. He liked to drive his own car, often by himself. And as you probably read in the Prince biography, one of his children once commented that my father has two main vanities. He loves his long white hair. He won't get it cut. And he likes to drive big cars and drive them fast. And he would take every opportunity to go to Huntsville to what he claimed would rejuvenate him, to find his roots, his moorings, and would find, as mentioned in his diary, a chance to rise early in the morning with the quiet and stillness of Huntsville and meditate and hopefully receive inspiration. So these were two men whose lives span a different era than which we live. Before I get into some other particular stuff about President McKay's diary, let me give you, I think, of interest, my own odyssey with the McKay diaries. And it's rather exceptional in that, first of all, I'm going to jump ahead here and add a little thing here I'm going to put in right now. Something we don't do as historians, which is not encouraged because it's not good history, and that is doing counterfactual history. We all do it, don't we, in our own lives? What if? What if I hadn't met so-and-so? What if I had have taken that job instead of this job? What if I hadn't married so-and-so? What if my child hadn't had this experience? What if when I had that fall and broke my leg, it caused things to happen in my life, which wouldn't have happened otherwise? And historians shouldn't do that, but one of our most prominent historians, Niall Ferguson from Harvard, couldn't resist that, and he had a book called Virtual History, What Could Have Been, and he had different authors write back what could have been. And I wonder, in the Arrington and McKay diaries, what would have been had they not been made available. In President McKay's instance, able to be published, and suppose Leonard had not kept a diary. Or furthermore, I have colleagues and friends who keep diaries. And last month I was talking to one of them, and I said, well, you've had a wonderful diary. I've seen you write. You're going to get it published? I see you have on your shelves there typed out. No, I've told my children that upon my death they are to burn them. I says, why have you kept 30 years of diaries if you're going to get rid of them? Because they're written for me, and I don't want anybody else to see them. I said, not even your own kids? No. I said some very personal things there, and I think I'll just have them destroyed. I didn't agree with that, but that was his position, and there others have been in the same position. So I think it's important to think about where would 20th century Mormon history be without these two diaries? And granted, these are fairly new. McKay diaries have been out for a number of years, and Leonard's have been out for 6 months or so. So one wonders, could history have been written without these diaries? And I guess I feel bad. Devery mentioned that we had three presenters. We actually had four at one time. Greg Prince, who couldn't come. I was hoping to ask him how much he would have missed in writing the history of President McKay's administration and of the Arrington biography. How much could you have done without the diaries in your writing? How much would have been left out? How much would have been unknown? How much would you not have thought about? And I would guess he would say quite a bit. So let me go back to my interaction with the diaries. Many decades ago, more than I want to admit, I was fortunate to apply for a job at BYU. I'm going to, kind of muse here about things that maybe not totally related, but you find interesting. In 1970, President McKay died, and shortly thereafter, Ernest Wilkinson resigned. And those two dates are not coincidental, because the jig was probably up with President Wilkinson. He knew that he had very few friends in Salt Lake, and upon President McKay's death, he was gone. But then the problem came with the new president, Dallin Oaks. What do we do with President Wilkinson? He's still on campus, still has an office here. He is such a go-getter, he won't stay out of our business. So they thought, we've got this 1975 date coming up, which will be the 100-year history of BYU. Why not put Ernest in charge of writing the centennial history? They did, and they hired a staff to help him research and write it, which I was one. I was a young neophyte in history, hadn't had a lot of experience, but I was excited, and I was given the opportunity to go to Salt Lake in 1972 to begin researching. And this is my first real foray in extensive everyday research. I had done some work up there with other professors, Marvin Hill and Tom Alexander, but never had a full-time job doing this. And I was overwhelmed by all the stuff up there. But the problem was, as we began to research, and this ties into Gary's presentation of Leonard Arrington. He starts in 1972, the same year we started. And one day in the old building, I ran to Leonard Arrington, and he was always cordial and nice. I'm not one of his inner circle, not even one of his outer circle, but we were friends. And he asked how we were coming with our research. I says, not very good. We can't get any records. He says, I'm having the same experience with that. Hopefully that'll change. So after a few months of unsuccessful access, we came back and had a very acrimonious meeting with President Wilkinson, who asked, what have you done the last 3 months in Salt Lake? I don't see much records you've done here. Where are the photocopies? Where are your notes? You had a list you presented to me of items that could be looked up to see if they had any relevance to BYU history. I don't see them. He says, well, President Wilkinson, we can't get into them. They're denied because they have the big R on the catalog. That's ridiculous. I'll make a call to Salt Lake. So he called Salt Lake and came back 2 days later and says, okay, I see the problem. I have a problem up there with one of the members of the quorum, and that'll change sometime. Do the best we can until then. And lo and behold, 4 months later, President Lee passed away, and he applied again to President Kimball's administration through Nathan Tanner and Howard W. Hunter, and they were all for it, and it told Ernest it's a go. So as young researchers, we were so anxious to get these records, and one of them we got into was President McKay's diary, which I didn't know existed until I saw in the catalog. And when I got into that diary, I thought, this is unbelievable, because I now see in his diary what I experienced as a young man and student and didn't know what was going on, and now I can see it all. So I thought, and by the time we got to this, by the way, the days of Camelot were in full sway, and we thought they'd never end. We thought that we're home free, access would be always there. So I made some mental notes to go back someday because I wanted to do more on President McKay. And then, as we know, Camelot ended, and access was closed off, so I thought, I'll never see the McKay diaries ever again. And then late 1990s, I became aware that Greg Prince was doing an administrative history of President McKay, and he came to the archives one day and met with me and says, this is what I'm doing, Harvard, can you help me? I said, well, you can't really do this without President McKay's diary. You know that. He says, yeah, I know that, but that's been taken care of. I wasn't sure what that meant, been taken care of. Had he been given access to that and nobody else knew that? So I didn't ask him, but it turns out later as I found out that he lives back in Maryland, and there was a new mission president called to the Washington, D.C. North Mission, who happened to be a renowned attorney in Salt Lake, a senior partner in one of the biggest firms in Salt Lake, and actually had ran for governor against Scott Matheson in 1980. And they were in the same ward back there, and they got talking and found out they had an interest in history. And this Bob Wright says, would you be interested in doing a bio of President McKay? He says, well, I'd love to, but we have problems with, you know, material. He says, oh, I have the McKay diaries. And how could you have the McKay diaries there in Salt Lake? He says, well, my aunt was Clara Middlemiss, and she never married, and she was a good friend of mine. I was probably her favorite nephew. I handled all her legal matters, and when she died, I was given access to her estate and went to the attic in her home and found all these papers and a copy of the diaries. So at that point, I called Greg and asked him if there's any way that once he finished his project, if I could do an editing job with the diary. And again, I should give kudos because of Gary Bejera and Smith Pettit, without their help and their grant to help me with this, I never would have got done. So that needs to be acknowledged. But the problem was Bob Wright, who was a brilliant attorney, was, like many of us, starting to have some mental issues and forgot lots. And there were times when he wasn't too lucid. And I had access to the physical copies, but there began to be some problems occur in the family. I'm not sure where they're going to go. There were people from the church who had asked to have them given to the church. Others had said, do we know, maybe we ought to do something else with them. So I caught him in a moment of weakness and contacted Greg Thompson at the U of U and said, why don't you come with me? You have some McKay material already in your collection. Let's try and talk Bob Wright into giving those as a donation to the U. And for some reason, that was a good day in Bob's life. He says, that's a good idea. They'll be safe there. So we got that negotiation done. And shortly thereafter, one of the kids thought that I was taking advantage of their dad, and I was talking, doing things he didn't want to do. So they called up the U of U and says, now, we want to have control over who has access to those journals. And this Mr. Heath, he's doing something. I'm not sure we want to do that. And Stan Larson, who was in charge of that, says, I'm sorry, they belong to us, and we have that discretion. So we'll handle it ourselves. So that was a wonderful kind of serendipity, how I got access to those. And the question has arisen from others, was that proper and correct? Did President McKay expect Claire to keep that copy herself and do with it what she wished? And I think he probably did. I mean, she had a copy at President McKay's approval, and I think she felt, because she did most of the transcription, that this was something that should be preserved and probably maybe in the right hands could be published someday. And she thought that her nephew, Bob Wright, was a good man to be in charge of that. So that's a brief history of how I got access to the journals and how they're available today. And when you think about that, there are not many journals of the president of the church that are available. I mean, we have the wonderful Joseph Smith Papers Project, and then we have some publications of Brigham Young's diaries and John Taylor's diary, which B.H. Roberts used, is now lost, right, Gary? It's not around anymore, the one he used for that biography of John Taylor. And it's my understanding that President Grant has one of the largest collections in the church, and those who have seen his diary, who have limited access to certain events or days, say it's a wonderful diary. I know Mike Quinn used it extensively. So think about if we had that diary available, how that would help explain the 20s, 30s, and the 40s. So we're very fortunate to have this diary available to us today. I want to read a quote here from B.H. Roberts of the Comprehensive History of the Church, where he wrote this, which I think pertains to both Arrington and McKay. "It is always a difficult task to hold the scales of justice at even balance when weighing the deeds of men. It becomes doubly more so when dealing with men engaged in a movement that one believes had its origin with God, and that its leaders on occasion act under the inspiration of God. Under such conditions, to so state events as to be historically exact, and yet, on the other hand, so treat the course of events as not to destroy faith in these men, nor in their work, becomes a task of supreme delicacy, and one that tries the soul and the skill of an historian. The only way such a task can be accomplished in the judgment of the writer is to frankly state events as they occurred, in full consideration of all related circumstances, allowing the line of condemnation or of justification to fall where it may, being confident that in the sum of things justice will follow truth, and God will be glorified in his work, no matter what may befall individuals or group of individuals." Now, I want to discuss a little bit about diaries as primary sources. We all rely on memory, don't we? My problem now is with no diary. Someday my kids are trying to get me to write a memoir. If I do that, it's going to be from memory. And that's better than nothing, but it's not very reliable. I want to just read one example that I always found interesting. Years ago, I read the in the introduction to Arthur Schlesinger's book on his life. He wrote in the preface a very interesting discussion that I think sums up the problem here. Quote, "As an historian, I well know the fallibility of memory. I remember lunching one day with Dean Acheson when he was writing his superb memoir, Present at the Creation. He seemed more than usually wrathful. I had a very most disconcerting morning, he said to me, calling urgently for a dry martini. I was writing about the decision in 1941 to freeze Japanese assets in the United States, the decision that we now know led the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. I have the most vivid memory of that meeting with President Roosevelt in his office. The president was sitting at his desk there. Cordell Hull, Secretary of State, was sitting opposite him, and I was in the chair by the secretary's side. I can close my eyes and see it today. But my damn secretary, Miss Evans, checked the record and found that Mr. Hull had been flu and was off to White Sulphur Springs recuperating. He wasn't even the meeting at all. I can't believe it." And that was only probably 15 years before. So memory is a tricky thing. And I've often liked Richard White, a former professor at the University of Utah, was writing a history of his mother and trying to test her memories with the actual facts of her life. And he said, quote, "I once thought of my mother's stories as history. I thought memory was history. Then I became an historian. And after many years, I have come to realize that the only careless historians confuse memory and history. History is the enemy of memory. The two stalk each other across the fields of the past, claiming the same terrain. History forges weapons from what memory has forgotten or suppressed. Few non-historians realize how many scraps of life leaves. These scraps do not necessarily form a story in and of themselves, but they're always calling stories into doubt, always challenging memories, always trailing off in forgotten places." We have these diaries here, that problem minimized. We have daily writing, and in the case of President McKay, he would have those dictated, and Claire would go home that very evening to her home. She had nothing else to do in her life. She was married to his life and his work. She would come back and have those typed in a nice big binder for that day. And she also did more. I didn't have time to include this in the book because she would include in that day's entry any letter from anyone that met that day with that person, or if there was a newspaper article, any newspaper that pertained to the event or the person of that day's entry, she would photocopy and put in the diary. So there are tens of thousands of pages of the President McKay's diary. So we can feel rather certain that there wasn't much of a memory gap. And in Gary's presentation here, he's told you about how Leonard kept a daily diary. And Gary has in the back of one of his appendices a wonderful example of a page that was typed by the secretary, and then on the margins, his corrections. So apparently Leonard was very careful about making sure that what he had dictated was being correctly analyzed and put down. Now, of course, there can be embellishment. There can be attempts to kind of shade things. But by and large, diaries seem to be the most authentic and the most accurate of sources we have, which is why I find that these diaries, more than anything else that we have in our late 20th century, give us the kind of the thumbnail sketch of what was going on in the church, in culture. And we all live for these times, most of us here. And to me, my shock wasn't so much that these were all completely new. I'd heard stories, I'd heard rumors, I'd heard papers given, I've heard adult stuff given here and there about what was going on in the church, culturally, ecclesiastically, theologically. But you never knew for sure because that was somebody's opinion they got from somebody else. But now we have in President McKay's diary, and Leonard does a great job of meeting people who would go back and tell stories of what happened. So we now have a chance to really have those things verified. I'm going to give you just a couple examples before I quit here to show you how that affected my life. I thought I knew what was going on in the 60s and 70s with President Benson. I was raised in Boise, Idaho, and my neighbor was President Benson's youngest brother, who was a fine man. Really enjoyed him, and I knew a lot about the Bensons. And then I got a mission call to Germany, and my mission president was President Benson's next younger brother. And then President Benson was called to be the European mission president in Frankfurt. So I had a pretty good idea of what the Bensons were about, but now I had his brother as my mission president. I had President Benson there in Europe. And on weekends, when I was in the mission home, he would travel from Frankfurt to Dusseldorf to be with his brother. And he would allow us to sit on conversations. And so I thought I knew what was going on. This is the era of the Cold War, of the John Birch Society, all these political problems. And I thought, I got it pretty straight. There on my Mr. President's desk was the Birch literature, American Opinion magazine. I heard President Benson tell us about the evils. And as I was ready to go home, he says, where are you going to school? And he goes, probably BYU. Watch out. We got some people down there who are socialists, and they will ruin your education. I says, would you give me some names? Sure. Don't take any classes from Dick Wortland or Dick Paul. Okay, I made a note of that. Well, as it turns out, Dick Wortland became a Council of the 70 and was a prominent poster for Ronald Reagan. And Dick Paul was a respected historian and a later vice president back in Illinois. So I thought I had this all put together because I had heard it from an apostle's mouth. So I came back to school, and I pretty much had my idea of what was up, who the good guys were, who the bad guys were, and what I should watch out for. Then I hear rumors that Harvard, that's not really the full story. I said, well, I've heard it firsthand, and I was there. I was there when the Bensons talked to me about this. They interviewed President McKay's diary, and all of a sudden, what I thought I knew, I didn't know at all. In fact, I was grossly misinformed. And I thought, how could I have been so wrong about that? Then the question arises, if I was so wrong about that experience, what else was I wrong about? And as I read the diaries of President McKay, I was wrong about a lot of things. And one of the great things about President McKay's diary is he brings to light things that we all hoped would be the case and thought should have happened, but didn't. For example, and this is speculation. We got time. I'll speculate. Sometimes in our church publishing culture, those who talk the most and publish the most get the most attention, and they become kind of the arbiters of theology and history. And those who are kind of quiet behind the scenes, who don't publish a lot, are kind of forgotten. So I grew up, my dad gave me his personal copy of Mormon doctrine. And as a priest in my ward, I'd take my scriptures and Mormon doctrine to class, because that really was the fifth standard work, right? And I thought, you know, next to Revelation, that's about as good as you're going to get it. So I had that and used to quote from that a lot. I taught a lot of Sunday school classes. Thought I had that pretty well under control. And those who did not accept Elder McConkie, were critical of him, were really off track. And then I read President McKay's diary where he is so disturbed by the book that he had Brother Romney and Brother Peterson review it. And after 10 months of study, they found almost 1,100 errors of doctrine in the book. And they called in Brother McConkie and asked him why he did that. And in a very magnanimous way, said, we can't really publicly attack you, because if we did that, it would ruin your career. So we'll just ask that to cease publication. And we'd hope that she wouldn't do that anymore. Wow, I missed it again. I thought I understood all the real stuff, and I'm seeing from the prophet's diary that there were serious problems with that reverberated throughout the church. Then there was the problem with civil rights. I was caught up in the late 60s with civil rights at BYU, and I took religion classes from, and not just religion, but other professors who find ways to justify the priesthood ban. And then I read in President McKay's diary, he tells the quorum on one occasion, that's not doctrine, it's just policy. Now, why did that get out during the 1960s, when that would have been very helpful? And then another occasion, I was brought up with the notion, as many of you were, that although we had given up polygamy, that it was still the order of heaven. And then President McKay says in one of his talks to the quorum, you know, that is not a doctrine. It was a policy, and any man and any woman who get married together as husband and wife will have just as many blessings as anybody who married in polygamy. Well, that never got out either, but it was there. And so the McKay diary helps to clarify, helps to change ideas about what we thought, what we knew. And President McKay was an articulate, generous man who was well-read and a man of wisdom. And so when you read his diaries, you can see where, although he had some of the problems of cultural constraints that he was raised with, which happens to all of us, as one time when President McKay one time said, God can make a prophet, but he can't unmake the man. The cultural themes stay with us. And President McKay, despite these limitations, comes through as a person who, in a very conservative time, although he was conservative, said and did things which make you proud to have him as our prophet. Of course, there's always those who think he should have done more. I know there's people who believe that. But given the time, his background, and circumstances, I believe he did an incredible job of leading the church and doing things that helped the church. And in closing, it strikes me that both these volumes, Arrington and McKay, have lessons to teach us. And although we don't subscribe to the idea that history repeats itself or there are lessons from history. What we learn from both these diaries, especially the Arrington diary, is we tried suppression, we tried to cover up things, we tried to close access. In President McKay's diary, he was opposed to those who would attack independent thought. He wanted everybody to have an opinion. You don't have to agree with it, but they should be allowed to speak. These were ideas that were healthy for society in general and Mormon culture in particular. And we learned from these two diaries that when those things are not taken seriously, we have problems. And I think we all thought that perhaps these lessons were learned. And now there are sometimes things that happen and occur which makes us wonder, did we learn those lessons? And that's why these two diaries, if you read them and see what they're trying to say and do, it gives you a perspective for the future, what we might want to avoid, how we might want to approach the various conflicts and issues and problems we have today, because we have a lot of them. But these two diaries offer a guidepost from the last century, which I feel are still very relevant. Thank you.